I documented the process for creating the jails. So I at least have the links that I use to make the jails the way I like them. So I can then go find the updated versions when they when I have to do this again.
What if you were to like print all those web pages to PDF and then like make a little personalized doc and then maybe print it out and put it on your fridge or something?
Look, Brad, what I'm doing is I set up a read the docs server and I'm got a fully HTML5 wiki based documentation system that's hierarchical. It has an ontology and pretty much I'm good to like we could put 300 people in here and get all the docs we need.
It's becoming my new Saturday morning ritual. I was spending some time on the archive.org page for the Computer Chronicles this morning. Wait a minute. God. What am I talking about? I am speaking to a Computer Chronicles veteran here. I just remembered.
That was the first time I was ever on national TV,
wow.
I think.
Wow. That's it was syndicated, right? It wasn't on like
PBS. No, it was on PBS.
Public television.
It was like any PBS show where like
syndicated across PBS stations, I mean.
Yeah, like, so I think I don't know how that worked, but I assume that like the stations that wanted a show paid the people who made the show a little bit of money, and then they got to run the show inside the PBS network.
Sure.
But yeah, Gordon Mong, who was one of my coworkers at Maximum PC, and I got called by them to bring. They wanted us to bring some high end gaming PCs from a magazine cover.
You had some interesting stuff to say.
Well, but like we did the magazine so far in advance that by the time they asked us to do that, we'd already sent those machines back. So we had to call, I think it was HP and Alienware or Compaq and Alienware maybe, and get them to send comparable machines to the ones that were on the magazine that were on newsstands then back. And
I can't believe they made you send the computers back. Stuart seemed pretty dazzled by the amount of stuff in that machine.
He was very excited about it because like the stuff that they usually did was boring. It was like they did a lot of laser printer episodes and stuff like that.
I love how stuffy it is.
It was
he's not stuffy. Like, he was a good host, but the topics.
Oh, he was awesome.
It's very like business world.
That's what computers were like then. This was in like 2001, 2002. And you know, people traded us at trade shows, even at Maximum PC, which was like a magazine that 300,000 people a month got, right? It was a substantial print publication. We were treated like children because we did like gaming and performance computing stuff and not serious computer business.
Because you weren't wearing slacks and talking about spreadsheets.
I mean, I probably was wearing khakis then. That was in khaki time.
Yeah. Anyway, that has become a warm, fuzzy, nostalgic blanket for me on Saturday morning to just pop on there and throw on an episode. Anyway, I found an episode from 1988 where they had a guy on there demoing a $600 CD-ROM.
Wow.
And he chose to do so by saying, hey, you can fit the entirety of the Boeing 757 maintenance manual on this one disc. And here it is. And it was all hypertexted up and clicking around in the service diagrams. And it was,
wow.
A throwback.
The future.
Yeah. The future.
Future.
The past is the future.
Welcome to Brad and Will Made a Tech Pod. I'm Will.
I'm Brad. I'm back.
Hey, welcome back, Brad. Hey, it's good to have you here.
I am so sad that I know I said this to you and Fitz last week, but as soon as you guys were done recording, I was so bummed that I missed that episode.
You asked questions. You were there.
Thank you. I was there.
Yeah, limited.
But my ability to pick his brain in a self-indulgent manner was a little limited.
How's the old schnoz? You sound a little stuffy, maybe?
I'm a little concerned about the acoustics I have going on up there, but I don't know.
Look, what you need to do is get some tubes and you just jam them up and you have them stick out the front so that then you always have a clear path.
Okay. Like turn it into a musical instrument even. I can just vary the tone.
We manually. Got a lot of people asking questions about I don't know. I think people were worried about you, Brad.
Oh, no.
What did you do?
Oh, it was. Oh, my gosh. I wish I had it's around here somewhere. The printout EOB from my insurance company.
Ooh.
There were somewhere around 8 to 9 oscopies and ectomies on there.
Which end, though? There's a good ostomy end and a bad ostomy end.
The nasal sinus area.
Okay, good.
Yeah. Had a lot of stuff going on up there,
but everything's fine. Nothing bad.
Yes. It's all removed and fixed at this point. So
we got you all reamed out.
Yeah.
Good.
Now I'm doing a sinus rinse every 12 hours. That's producing all kinds of spectacular results.
Ooh, you should make an Instagram for that. You should document this.
You don't want to see that.
Look, I've been on some Reddits that imply that there's a market for literally any piece of content your body can produce.
What is the rule of 34 for this whatever it is? Let's not get into that.
Yeah, no.
Let's move on.
Hey, you know what happened this week?
What happened?
Well, it's a special time in every young man's life when one of the big game engine companies releases a new version of their engine.
Ah, that magical time of year.
And they show you, before the hardware people are really ready to talk about it, what the hardware on the next generation platform is going to do.
The flowers are blooming, the bees are buzzing, and a tech demo for a new engine or piece of hardware is upon us again.
Yes. And this time it was here's what the PS5 can do with Unreal Engine 5.
Yeah.
It's nice that the numbers sync up finally. Yeah. Nice job, guys.
Finally, after all these generations, they've dialed in this branding synergy.
The name scheme is finally, it's working out. So
we haven't neither of us have watched this yet.
And no.
I think we had talked about doing like a live watch react kind of thing, but
we don't know how interesting that's going to be. Yeah, so we're going to play it.
Yeah. And also, you know, like I skimmed through it. It sounds pretty like narration heavy and pretty dense with info. So that kind of thing is pretty tough to talk over.
But this week we're going to talk about the Unreal Engine 5 tech demo they released this week. We're also going to talk about the cool filmmaking stuff that Unreal is doing now with real time effects as seen in The Mandalorian.
Yeah. Like video games are cool and all, but the stuff they're doing in kind of rapid fire TV production is the stuff that's really fascinating to me.
It's one of those. Look, the thing that they're doing with we'll get into how it works, but the thing that they're doing with The Mandalorian isn't. It's one of those things that like somebody was like, hey, you know, we have this technology and this technology and this technology, and if we put them all together in a kind of novel way, then something really cool is possible.
Yeah.
And maybe it'll work. Let's figure it out. And then it worked and it's really cool. And like, had I not known how they did this stuff, I never would have believed what they were doing.
Okay. So that's, I don't want to cannibalize the latter half of the episode, but I've got stuff to ask about.
It's on Unreal Engine 5 revealed, next gen reveal 3 days ago, 10 million and a half views. That's the one.
The YouTube channel called Unreal Engine has it. That's the perfect place to go find it if you want to watch it along
with
us. We'll
put a link in the show notes too. Do you want to load this bad boy up and hit the play button?
Yeah. Should I watch the 1080p version or the 4K version?
I mean, how many P's does your monitor have, Brad? Mine has 4K P's.
Only 1080.
Oh, what? Oh, I'm sorry. But I'm going to watch the 4K version.
Yeah, so hopefully they're the same. If I downscale this 4K version to 1080p, it'll look better, right?
Look, you got four times as many pixels making each pixel. So yeah, that math reads.
Right. Oh, and we should mention that if you don't want to hear us react to this thing live, or if you've already seen it or whatever, and you'd rather just skip to the part where we talk about it afterwards, the video is just about exactly 9 minutes long. So if you skip ahead 9 minutes, you'll get there starting now.
I see an Unreal logo, an Epic logo. Now I see an Unreal logo. It's shiny.
Hello, I'm Brian Karras, Technical Director of Graphics here at Epic Games.
Hi, I'm Jérôme Plateau, Art Director of the Special Project.
A few years ago, we got together as a team and brainstormed where we thought we could push forward the state-of-the-art in real-time graphics. There were two key areas that stood out. The first, dynamic global illumination. Beautiful bounce lighting, instantaneously.
I don't have to be constrained to do a game where the world has to be static. And I'm able to iterate a lot faster.
And we call this new system Lumen. We're about to show you what it is capable of. But first, there was another area that we thought we could push forward, truly virtualized geometry.
Ooh.
Artists wouldn't have to be concerned over poly counts, draw calls, or memory. We could directly use film quality assets and bring them straight into the engine.
And that's a big deal for artists. I just want to be able to import my ZBrush model, my photogrammetry scan, my CAD data, without wasting any time optimizing, creating LODs, or even lowering the quality to make it hit frame rate.
In the end, that's what it's all about. Art that just works. And we call this new technology Nanite. Here is the future of Unreal Engine running live on a PlayStation 5.
Awesome. Let's take a look at it.
This has to be the right way.
Wow.
Oh, have you not seen any of this footage?
No.
Before we continue, let's stop a moment and take a look at some of the key features of this demo. Much of what you see was built with Quixel Megascan assets, but instead of using the game versions, we used the cinematic versions, which would typically only be used in film.
Wow.
And thanks to virtual texturing, they all use 8K textures as well. Nanite can render an insane number of triangles very quickly. There are over a billion triangles of source geometry in each frame that Nanite crunches down losslessly to around 20 million drawn triangles. What does that many triangles look like?
Oof.
These are the triangles, each a different color. Most are so small that they look like noise.
Yeah, every polygon is just a pixel.
Yeah.
Oh, there you go.
This amount of geometric detail requires shadows to be pixel accurate as well, and Nanite can do that too. Speaking of lighting, all of the lighting in this demo is complete.
That's amazing.
With the power of Lumen, that even includes multi-bounce global illumination. No light maps, no baking here. Without GI, all of that beautiful lighting is gone. With Lumen enabled, we can move the light and the bounce changes.
They figured out some new math.
Okay, let's keep going.
I want to know if that's ray traced, but we can talk about it later.
It's not. They actually said it's not.
Oh.
We've made some great additions to our audio system as well. Convolution Reverb allows us to measure reverberation characteristics of real spaces, like actual caves that we sampled, and reproduce them in virtual spaces. Sound Field Rendering allows us to record and playback spatialized audio. All of this adds up to a more immersive experience.
They're doing a better job of the hair than current stuff, too.
This swarm of bats was created with our Niagara effects system. Particles in Niagara can now talk to one another and understand their environment.
Oh, wow.
We've also added a ton of new functionality to run fluid simulations like you see in the water below.
I want to see the collision of the hands on the rocks.
The demo runs on our Chaos Physics system. Here we are using it to accurately simulate the rigid bodies of the falling rocks and the cloth of her scarf.
But does that scarf clip through a sword when it's on her back? That's the real question.
I mean, it's not clipping through the bottom of her skirt thing.
It's true. The next generation is here.
Now that the environment is so complex, we've needed to greatly improve our animation systems to adapt. We've added predictive foot placement and motion warping, which dynamically modifies IK and body position to look more natural. For the character to more realistically interact with the environment, we've added the ability to trigger seamless contextual animation events, like her hand on the door.
That's promising.
Dynamic GI is amazing, not just for speeding up iteration, but also for its impact on gameplay.
Nice.
Any light source can move while still having beautiful bounce lighting. Dynamic illumination means spectrum as well, which you can see on all the metal surfaces. You can even see the Niagara-powered bugs reacting to the light.
That's super cool.
Lumen not only reacts to moving light sources, but also changes in geometry. Remember we mentioned high poly assets? This statue was imported directly from ZBrush and is more than 33 million triangles. No baking of normal maps, no authored LODs.
Wow.
Yeah,
I think authored is the key word there.
Yeah, like the simplification of the asset pipeline is going to be huge with this, right?
We can do more than a single statue. There are nearly 500 of that exact statue at the same detail level placed in this room for a total of over 16 billion triangles.
I mean, but that's instance. That's not, that isn't, the new thing there is the
There are hundreds of billions of triangles.
I wonder if those statues can be dynamic. Like if they can move or you can move them.
So with Nanite, you have limitless geometry, and with Lumen, you have fully dynamic lighting and global illumination, all running on a PlayStation 5.
Wow.
There's not much time left.
And this doesn't need to be constrained to small rooms. It can stretch all the way to the horizon.
The portal, it's open. Don't fail me now.
Wow.
It's time to see what's next.
Man, they hit the subharmonics hard. Got arm chills.
Unreal Engine V has come too, apparently.
Yeah. Well, that's for the Xbox Series X, because V is before X. So you get V on the Xbox and you get 5 on the PS5.
They're just getting them back for that 360 move.
Yeah, that's bananas.
Yeah. Feeling pretty good about that.
I mean, look, if you compare that to the great Unreal Engine tech demos of times past, there was what? The UE3 one was the one that showed what was going to be Gears.
Right, with the Brumac stomping around and like, what was the big... I guess like normal mapping and that sort of thing was normal mapping. I mean, like, you know, DX8 programmable shader stuff back then was the big innovation.
It might have been DX9 even, was but it was because it was
you're right,
360
you're right.
generation.
Yes, you're right.
But it was like particles. There were like dust motes and light beams, stuff like that. It was the incredible amount of detail on the like the smashed concrete brutalist architecture geometry in the world and stuff like that. And then I think the UE4 one was that Citadel thing, right? The Citadel fly through.
That sounds right.
It's like a castle with lots of shiny bricks. And I feel like that one was kind of underwhelming. This one was very good.
Yeah, the last one was pretty iterative, I think, on the previous one, but this felt very much like a generational shift.
Well, so this one showed more character and world interaction stuff than the last one did too, which was interesting. I feel like the shadowing stuff and the dynamic lights, the fact that they're not baking light maps to do geometry that complex is really impressive. It means we'll be able to have like lights changing during games and things like it's going to open up more of the kind of like time of day changes that we see in stuff like Stardew and Animal Crossing to more 3D rendered, like more realistic looking games.
Sure.
That and the art pipeline stuff seem like the big deals to me.
Yes, the effect on creating assets for stuff seems like the actual big story there. But like, I feel like virtualized geometry is like the kind of standout phrase from that thing to me. Does that read to you? Like, what exactly does that mean to you? Like,
I don't know what virtualized geometry you mean. Referencing the statues?
Yeah. Well, no, it was early on. It was when they first revealed that first part of the cave, and they were pulling the camera in. And I mean, in a practical sense, I think what they're really talking about is just a truly seamless like tessellation of the background. Like, you're not seeing. He even mentioned the term authored level of detail, right? Like, you're not seeing rigid levels of detail popping in and out anymore. But I don't know. Under the hood, like in the code, I don't know what virtualizing that means exactly in a software sense.
So yeah, right now, like if you were, so for example, in a game, like the when we were doing Fusho, the amount of time we spent making assets performant on the target platform that we wanted to run on, which was usually like PC, you know, PC VR. So times two, what was it? A GeForce FX 9970 running at 90 Hertz times two.
Like decent
for each eye.
Decent, yeah. Min spec, right?
Yeah, but like the amount of time we spent trying to get assets to run at that target was enormous. So if like that, if that work can happen automatically instead of with some artist moving moving levers and dials, it means that you can create a lot more art and spend a lot less time making the art that you create
right.
run.
Like you're just making the, it sounds like you're just making the one master version, like the hero asset, right, of the model or the background, and, yeah, and the engine does all the work of making it run smoothly.
That sounds right. It's funny. We did an episode with the Creative Assembly guys for Total War Warhammer 2, and they make assets that are like film quality assets for those things for cutscenes. And then that's pretty much, then they scale them down for the things. But if you could just dump the film quality assets, you don't have to do the low poly versions and make all the LODs and, you know, atlas your textures and all the other stuff that you have to do that's like technical.
Yeah. So that seems to be the upshot of that topic. And also that's the practical effect in terms of the art labor. But I would love to hear, and I'm sure neither of us is equipped to figure this out, but I would love to hear from like a low level graphics programmer what exactly is happening. Like what does it mean to virtualize that process?
But yeah. I mean, I have the gist, but I think there's a lot more to it than that because we would have done it before if it was easy.
Right.
The other thing was the fluid and the particle systems, so the difference between a particle system and a fluid system is that fluids interact with each other as they're moving. Yeah. Right. So like if you want to simulate air moving through skyscrapers in a city like Chicago, you know, you have to simulate each square and then simulate its effect on all right. the adjoining squares, and then simulate the adjoining squares effect back on them. And it quickly becomes a nightmare of loopbacks.
Deep down, like water molecules are just slipping and sliding all over each other, right?
Yeah, exactly. But the particle interaction and the fluid things, I think, are probably very similar processes, because like the idea that that'll allow things like flocking behavior in birds, because, you know, flocking behavior is determined by, you know, each bird's position is determined by all the other birds' position, and like the swarms of beetles that we saw moved more like real swarms of beetles than anything I've ever seen, rather than like a canned animation.
Yeah, like you have to assume that was a particle based effect too, right? The beetles.
But yeah, that's what they said. Yeah.
I mean, it feels like just another, and this is going to like loop back around to the topic later in the episode. It feels like another example of filmmaking techniques, VFX techniques, just bleeding into games now that games can actually run them and the hardware can run them in real time.
Yeah.
Because like going back 20 years, like the massive tool that they developed for the Lord of the Rings movies, you know, like that was a massive.
That was the army thing, right?
Yeah, that was just a big, I started to say a massive system, because of course it is, because that's what it's called. But that was just a huge system of agents that had primitive behaviors programmed in to either like attack each other or run away from each other or blah, 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 you know, but like that's kind of what we're talking about, except now in real time with actual little discrete systems playing out in the world around you, right?
Well, it's stuff from like emergent tools like Game of Life, right? Like if you load that thing up and you give it different source, you give it the same feeds, you're going to get different results every single time, because the things interact with each other differently based on the starting location.
It's a chaotic system, right?
Yeah. But small imperfections in the skin, Brad.
That's right. We're just get Jeff Goldblum in here to explain this to us.
Exactly. But yeah, this is fascinating. So the other thing that's huge is the amount of geometry that they showed in those levels was like kind of terrifying.
Yeah. Well, that's where the virtualization comes in, right? Is like you can just have, I'm not going to say unlimited numbers of polygons in your background, but it sounds like you can kind of just throw whatever at it and it'll figure it out.
Well, you said it during when we were talking about it, but you said some of these polygons are only a pixel, and yeah, it looks like some of the polygons are even smaller than pixels, totally, depending on where you are and what, but I mean, that'll solve the problem of, you know, your MIP maps popping in and your tessellation popping in as you close the LOD gaps. Cause it should just render dynamically all the way down and tessellate out. I mean, the nice thing is now they can assume everybody that's going to be playing these games is going to have tessellation hardware, which wasn't always the case. And that opens up a lot more. And I believe wasn't even the case for the previous gen of consoles, but it might have been.
Yeah.
So yeah, that opens up a lot of possibility there.
Yeah. But you want to talk some more about the global elimination? It sounds like you've seen some comments they've made subsequent to the video. Because I would have thought, and there were even some people on the TechPod Discord who assumed that GI stuff was ray tracing based, but it sounds like they came out and said it's not.
So the thing I like, this is my memory of an offhand comment on Twitter, but they said, I saw somebody say that there was no ray tracing.
Interesting. In okay.
And honestly, it didn't look like there was ray tracing. It looked better than what you get with current gen ray tracing.
Less noisy.
But yeah, because it didn't have the noise pop in because right now it's basically interpolating a light map based in real time based on a really limited some sample of rays.
Right.
And that looked like projection lighting. It didn't look like light probes to me, but I it's hard to tell in video because there's weird compression with video.
That's another interesting illustration of the point that, like, lighting in particular in games, but all, you know, all types of graphical effects, the fuzziness of doing it the quote unquote like real way versus faking it, like the fakery is often better and higher quality at a current state of hardware capability than doing it the right way.
Well, Unreal has always done lighting backwards compared to most other engines, so they they were getting self-shadowing and stuff on those assets, which was interesting. Like, when you looked at the light moving across the cliff faces, you would see rocks dangling down, shadowing the rocks behind them, stuff like that. They were also getting some good specular and some bounce back on the other surfaces and if they're doing that without doing ray tracing, then they figured out something really cool. Mm-hmm. So I'm interested. I assume that they're going to do, I think they said they're going to do a deep dive in how they're doing all this stuff.
I can't wait for that. That sounds great.
But it's really neat.
However they're accomplishing that stuff, it illustrates the same point as ray tracing, which is just kind of I'm trying to think of a way to describe this. It's almost like an author wants light many kind of situation. You know what I mean? It's just like place the lights and just let the tech figure out how to shade the entire world.
Well, I mean, if there's no pre-computed lighting, like, calculating light maps takes an astonishing amount of time, especially if you're talking about like a game, like a big open world game, right? So if you look at, you know, a PUBG map that's, you know, 8 kilometers by 8 kilometers, or even, you know, something like Skyrim or Zelda or whatever, and if you're doing pre-computed light maps, those can take an incredibly long time, even if you're like throwing like small supercomputer assets at them.
Let me jump in real quick. This is probably going to sound incredibly naive to any working game developers that are listening to this, but when they mentioned in that demo, like, you don't have to pre-compute light maps anymore, I was like, wait, are people still pre-computing a lot of light maps? Like, I guess I just assumed that we had gotten to the point, not where we had completely moved past it, but it wasn't as common as it used to be, because, like, going way back to, like, you know, the late 90s when, like, the original Quake engine games were out there, like, you used to hear all the time, it's like, that's the thing that took all of the time in the sort of level creation pipeline, right? In terms of computing output, building stuff by hand, but once you were ready to, like, bake it into the game, like, that's the thing that you have to run on, like, an SGI overnight or whatever.
Yeah. So now, I know for a long time, Valve had a thing that ran on all their computers that would basically, like, folding at home their light map computation.
Oh, wow. That's awesome.
I'm sure other people did similar stuff.
Jim in accounting wanted that $9,900K, then we're going to put it to work when he's not doing spreadsheets.
Exactly. So that was longer ago than a $9,900K, obviously. Yeah. Yeah, people do light maps because they're very performant.
Right.
I mean, all a light map is basically a texture that says, hey, this part of the map should be bright and this part of the map should be dark.
Right.
Like maybe colored.
The benefit is it's very performance efficient, but the downside is it's static, right? You can't do anything really dynamic with it.
But you can combine that with other stuff. So like, if you're building something for the Oculus Quest, which is a mobile part that can handle maybe 2 or less than 10 dynamic lights at any given moment before the performance shits the bed. So if you do the basic world lighting for all the light sources that can't be changed, can't be turned on and off, can't be moved. I mean, because turning on and off, actually, you just flip a different light map on. But if you can pick up the light and move it across the room or point it at something, like you can and say control, then that has to be a dynamic light.
Right.
So you pre-compute all the static lights and then you do the dynamic lights, as dynamic lights.
Yeah, that's how it's been done for the last, 20-25 years at this point?
Forever, yeah, for all intents and purposes.
But I guess what I meant is I figured we had already largely gone through that transition, but it sounds like I was assuming a lot.
Well, I mean, there's other stuff like Unity. People in Unity use light probes for stuff. There's which are like kind of in between. They don't require pre-computing, but they're not dynamic. So they're only good for certain pretty specific circumstances. So like most of the lighting solutions, including light maps, are good at some things and bad at others. And it's like any other tool. You pick the tools that work
right
for what you want to do. And I assume some engines handle things differently. I haven't spent any time working with Unreal Engine, but I can tell from looking at shadows on games like PUBG and Fortnite that they're pre-computing light maps for the world there. So that like, if you have, for example, like a guard booth that has some windows and some vertical rails, and then you see shadows inside that guard booth based on where the sun is, those things were all pre-computed because when they bug out, they make all sorts of interesting interference patterns.
Right. And those are games where you're playing and the maps are a little kind of static sandbox, right? Like you don't need to worry about time of day or weather effects or stuff like that so much.
Right. There are hacks you can do. For example, like in a game like Skyrim where you want the sun to move across the sky, you just compute 360 light maps for different sun positions and you blend between them as the day goes on. Right?
You will see that in probably most, I would say, games that do have time of day, like open world games. If you just watch shadows on the ground, you'll see them ticking along in like very rigid increments rather than a smooth gradient.
Yeah. So something like Minecraft is a good example of a dynamic light, but they can do it because they treat each voxel face as like one pixel face for calculating the math. So it's relatively straightforward.
Yeah.
So the lighting stuff is really huge. There's a benefit. The other big benefit there is that the artist can literally if you're doing all dynamic lights, the huge benefit is you can see what your changes look like in real time rather than having to change them and then bake the light map. And, you know, usually you bake a low res version of the light, but you have fast light map to get an idea. And then you don't know what it really looks like until you do the 24 hour run or whatever the big run is. And anytime you're doing that stuff, either you have to have a machine that's dedicated to that, or you have to just not use your workstation for the time that it's running because it's going to eat all the CPU and video card on that machine.
Do you think there are a lot of artists out there that are just like falling to their knees and praising the heavens because it sounds like they're going to be able to just export their high-res assets and just drop them straight into the development version of the game, right?
I think people are gun-shy about that because we've heard that is a thing that a lot of middleware promise. You know, it's one of those things when you walk around the middleware booths at GDC, it's like, hey, take your high-res cinematic assets and just drop them straight in. And then it never actually works out that way.
I feel I would maybe give that kind of rhetoric a little more credibility coming from an Epic than your average middleware display at GDC. But
I think that's true. And also, if they're going to come out and hype it up like that, then they're going to have... like they feel like they have a pretty robust solution.
That's what I mean.
It's like applicable to a lot of people.
They can't really get away with blowing a lot of smoke, right? Because their tool is so widely used by so many different applications. Like if it doesn't live up to what they're pitching, then we're going to know pretty quickly.
Yeah, I think that's fair. The other thing that I thought was interesting was they talked about sound, which seems increasingly important. The spatial sound recording and stuff like that is a real dark art and it's, like you get into that, like people started experimenting that with binaural audio when VR started taking off, because binaural, meaning that you literally put microphones inside things that are shaped like human ears. And so you can get a recording of what the sound is going to sound like right at the point, you know, inside your ear canal. And then when you play that back through headphones, it mimics the spatial stuff. So people use that for like 360 and 180 videos a lot. The programmatic version of that is HRTFs, which are head related transfer functions, I think is what that stands for. But basically they use math to mimic the same thing. And they do a little bit of delay on like when the sound plays in your left ear and your right ear so that, you know, your brain interprets that as it would a sound coming from, you know, above and behind you or whatever, something you can't do with just normal stereo separation. I'm interested to see how the sound field stuff that they're talking about, which is the next, like a more complicated version of that. It's when you use multiple microphones in an array to capture like really accurately your sound stuff. And I'm interested to see what they're doing with that as well.
Yeah.
They didn't really talk about it too much.
Yeah. Another thing that stood out to me is that sequence right at the end where she's basically just running and sort of flying and gliding through a massive amount of level design in a very short period of time.
Yeah.
Which seemed like it had the dual purpose of saying, look how fast we can stream these complex assets off of this insanely fast storage mechanism. And also here is us scaling all this complex geometry and you're not seeing any pop in any, anything, right? It was just like pretty flawless looking.
I would really love to see the pipeline for, because I think they said that first cave was a scan.
Yes.
The one where they paused it. And I'd love to see the timeline for the artists that worked on that level.
Yes, that is.
And see how much time was spent with the scan, cleaning it up and applying textures and like fixing overhangs and holes and stuff like that. Because I know anytime, like we did some laser scanning stuff for the tested episode of the Foo Show where we went to Adam's Cave. And I know that the folks that did that spent an incredible amount of time both cleaning up, like cleaning up noise from reflections and transparency and stuff like that. But then also, you know, like making, like, I guess what I'm saying is when you do the 3D scans, at least with the stuff that I've used, you end up with usually a point cloud that's just a whole bunch. That's basically here's all the bounce backs and here's the colors we got at these different areas. And then you run the point cloud through a tool that turns it into a mesh. And the hard part isn't, the hard part of that process isn't turn the point cloud into a really high resolution mesh. The hard part is fix the errors in the scan,
right?
You know, so that you have something that doesn't have holes and doesn't unfairly represent the thing that you're trying to scan and stuff like that.
Have you ever seen a raw version of one of those environment scans? Like it does look a little nightmarish in spots, you know, like there are parts where something was obscured and you just have, like you said, a giant gaping hole in it.
Yeah.
Things can look smeared.
Yeah, it's almost like the landscape version of the Uncanny Valley, because you look at it and your brain is like, this is not how rocks look, right?
So like this, that's kind of a bedroom. It's like a nightmarish skewed version of one.
Well, and also most of the photogrammetry is one of those things that is exactly as good as the technology and effort that you put into creating the source photos.
Yeah.
We tried to do a photogrammetry scan of Adam's workshop, which is an incredibly noisy, it's like worst case environment for photogrammetry, right? There's a lot of visual noise. There's rafters, there's stuff hanging from rafters. So there's occlusion everywhere.
Fair amount of shiny metal, I would bet.
Tons of shiny metal, tons of glass, tons of shadows, tons of bright spots. Like it's not a good, like
a lot of high frequency detail in there.
Yeah, you want like a soundstage, a blank, empty black sure. box to do photogrammetry, right? And this is not that. And we spent 2 or 3 days collecting photos and then tried to munge in like the smallest area, and it just couldn't handle it, right? It kept crashing the tool we were using.
That's a good reality check for me, because that was my big final question coming out of this demo.
Well, that was also with prosumer tools, not necessarily like film quality tools.
Okay, sure.
So it's possible that there's better tools out there for different markets.
Because there have been, even in the past generation of games, there's been a couple really impressive examples of techniques like that. I want to say that the Star Wars Battlefront games have used photogrammetry pretty well.
Those environments?
Yes. Well, I think Forza 7, one of the Forzas, I believe they were touting it. For some of their environments.
I can see that.
Canyons, rock, you know, it seems like a good technique that's well suited to a lot of large, fairly flat rocks.
So photogrammetry works best when the objects around you don't move.
Right.
Like grass is bad for photogrammetry. Leaves are bad for photogrammetry.
Yeah, I mean, that's the kind of thing you would want to just generate artificially, right?
I think so. Yeah.
Combination of art and code or something like that.
So in order to make the grassy environments, first we plow up, we pave over all the grass.
Yep, that's right.
And then you cut down all the trees, and then you take your photogrammetry and then you apply the grass and the trees on top with a paintbrush.
That's the history of human civilizational development, right?
Yeah.
Destroy the natural world in order to recreate it. Yes. So the thing I was going to ask though is, I mean, going back to the kind of history of visual effects again, and this is kind of inverting the example a little bit, but like, they've been scanning maquettes, physical models, you know, made out of clay or whatever, you know, a lot of people can work a lot faster by hand or, you know, get finer detail in some cases. That's not to denigrate the discipline of 3D modeling. Obviously, you can get a lot of great results with that too. But the point is, like, you could have a sculptor make a model, scan that in as an incredibly high resolution model, and then turn that into a character in a movie. They were doing that like 20 years ago. Like I've wondered if we, and I don't know, maybe you can speak to this. Like, do you think we're ever going to get to the point where maybe in at least in some cases where it's appropriate, you're not building levels in a computer, but you are building sets on a stage and scanning those in as the basis of your level. You know what I mean? Like that.
Wow.
Because you talk about the amount of art that gets outsourced, you know, like some of these environments with the like insane amounts of discrete art, you know,
even something like Assassin's Creed, the modern Assassin's Creed games have just a terrifying amount of art in them.
Right. And you see how much, even in like high budget games, how much of that just gets iterated over ad nauseum, you know, it's like, oh, there's that church again for the 12th time and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And it makes me wonder in a lot of cases, it's like, oh, instead of having people model unique packs of cigarettes and ashtrays and like whatever, you know, could you see cases where instead you are just scanning environments that are, you can set dress probably a lot faster than you can generate all that stuff artificially, right?
So in a world where like movie and TV tie-in games didn't essentially move mobile like 5-6 years ago, I could definitely see like somebody going into the Iron Man set Iron Man 2 and scanning that and using that as the basis for you know, your world hub because for the Iron Man 2 game or whatever.
Because you've already spent the budget on that set and it already exists.
Yeah. I don't think people are going to build physical environments because it's usually a lot cheaper to just do it digitally. That's why we do a lot of shooting on green screens. And we're going to talk about that with The Mandalorian because it is applicable here.
Yeah.
But what I can see happening is, like, if you go to a prop shop in LA, you can go to these huge, huge warehouses where they have like, you know, 3,000 different packs of cigarettes from the last 50 years. And you can get like, if you're making a film set in the 70s, you can get a pack of Marlboros from the 70s and have that and you rent that or buy it or whatever for your shoot.
Right.
So, or, you know, if you're making a 12 Monkeys game and you need a black hard side Samsonite suitcase from 1993, you can go find the black Samsonite hard side suitcase from 1993.
Right.
What I could see is people going through and scanning, especially for like if you're making a Jason Bourne game, you go to the hand prop store in LA and you rent all the shit that you need for that game, like the actual physical items. And then you scan them and then you de-brand them as needed to make the legal team happy. But you have essentially, you know, the trade dress of the era specific props for the game that you're making. I totally see that working for props.
Sure. In fact, actually I saw that very idea floated as a negative on Twitter. That this sort of new emerging model could in fact lead to a lot more people just relying on existing asset libraries. So you're actually going to see a lot more of the same art popping up in different places and that sort of thing.
I mean, you're always this doesn't have anything to do with asset libraries, right? The asset libraries are there. They're available.
That's true.
We know, like, what's the best game that did a bunch of asset flipping? Probably it's like, I mean, Bennett Foddy made Getting Over It, which is about found assets and all that.
That's fair,
like,
that's appropriate thematically.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of mobile games that use, I mean, I know I mentioned PUBG a lot, but PUBG used a lot of assets that are from the Unreal Asset Store for like the first map because they didn't have a huge art team. The asset store is always going to be a problem. You're not going to get massive scanned libraries because scanning stuff is expensive and time consuming enough that it's not like uploading your photos from Flickr to Getty Images and hoping you're going to get $3 for somebody licensing your photo.
Yeah.
If you spend 40 hours building a fire tower in Blender or Maya or something, and you're not going to just upload it hoping that somebody pays you $50 for it 10 times and makes it worth your 3 days work or whatever it was.
Sure. That's probably for the best because, you know, you talk about all the like kind of ready to go rental prop and set services in LA and that sort of thing. If people were getting to the point where they were just like scanning stuff like that in for level design, that would lead to the situation where the police station that you put in your game turned out to be the same one that you saw in that porn.
Yeah.
A couple of years ago.
Yeah. Or like you're recording your E3 shows and somebody's like, I saw this. I recognize this from somewhere. I can't tell where.
Yeah. So let's say whether you're covering E3 or making video game levels, be careful what kind of studio space you rent.
Yeah.
And or scan.
And then the other thing is like style always matters more than quantity of art, right? Sure. Like more art doesn't beat better designed, more stylish art ever.
Yeah.
So like if you have a billion polygons, that's great. But if the billion polygons look like crap, I would rather play Wind Waker with, you know, a handful of polygons running on a GameCube 20 years ago than, you know, whatever your giant hyper poly,
totally,
whatever extravaganza
totally
is.
Totally.
Okay. So speaking of Unreal,
yes,
let's talk about The Mandalorian.
Okay.
I watched the entirety of this show almost before I found out how they shot a lot of the scenes. And when I found out, I was blown away.
So that is fascinating for me to hear, because I have not seen any of the show, but I have watched all of the stuff they've put out just about the production of it. So I came at it from the other angle of like, oh, I know how they made that, even though I haven't seen it. So hearing you say that they fooled you is like, that's pretty much the proof in the pudding, right?
I was.
It worked.
I assumed it was all green screen, if not shot on location. And I was very surprised. Yeah. So the thing we're talking about, so The Mandalorian is Jon Favreau is the executive producer on a show called The Mandalorian, which is on Disney Plus. It's the first Star Wars TV show, and you have to subscribe to the service to get it. The neat thing about The Mandalorian is that instead of shooting in front of green screens, which they did obviously shoot in front of some green screens and then composite in digital stuff on top of that, but a lot of like their exterior shots are shot on a soundstage with an LED video wall, a high res LED video wall that kind of curves behind the circular stage. And then what they do is they motion track the camera lens and they render the backgrounds live while the actors are performing, and perspective warp those backgrounds so they look 3D correct from wherever the camera happens to be. So when you're standing off to the side, they look, you've seen those chalk drawings that like sidewalk artists do, where when you're walking up, it looks like there's a guy standing on the sidewalk from like the exact right spot. And then as you get closer, the guy gets stretched out until he's yes, like 30 feet long on the sidewalk.
Yeah.
It's like that.
Yeah.
But they're doing it live using the Unreal Engine to render the right assets in the background.
And because it moves across the wall from the camera's point of view, it always looks perspective correct, right?
Yeah. So there's two things happening. Anytime the camera moves, the wall is rendering the perspective from exactly where the camera is.
Right. Which requires like an incredibly fine level of motion tracking.
I mean, it's what you would use for VR, because it's literally the same thing that happens when you wear a Vive. And you're moving your head left and right.
It's funny when you put it that way. That sounds incredibly simple, but for whatever reason, like applying that to a large camera that's like balanced on a guy's shoulder makes that seem a lot more difficult for some reason.
Well, but I mean, just to be clear, we do that too for things like virtual sets. For like ESPN uses virtual sets for all of their of their stuff. So it's like a huge green screen room and the camera moves and is tracked and they're rendering the background based on where the camera position is.
I mean, that's probably a camera on a jib that's doing pretty predictable, like smooth movements, right? As opposed to a guy with like a handheld rig.
Well, so they don't, I'm trying to think. I guess there were some handheld shots in this. I don't remember a ton of handheld shots.
Okay. Because in some of the, so there's a lot of, I guess we'll put this in the show notes, there's a fair amount of like behind the scenes footage they've put out on this stuff, and at least in a lot of those demos they do show people walking around with cameras and doing it live. But
so there's definitely handheld shots. A lot of them felt like gimbaled or steadicams, like gimbaled shots or steadicams. Sure. I don't remember a lot of like, you know, like war photographer style, shaky, like running in shape. Like I don't remember any Cloverfield business
on sides. Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, but at the same time, like with the Vive, you can get the level of resolution and fidelity and that you would need to do this. So even if they have a Vicon set up around the edge and they have the camera with a Vicon marker on it, that's, they're going to get the speed that they need probably.
The interesting thing,
Disney Gallery is a series on Disney Plus, and they have, as of yesterday when I watched it, two episodes up about The Mandalorian. They just posted the third one yesterday, and they do it like Jon Favreau's old show, Dinner for Five, which was, I think, an A&E thing where he would get five directors or actors or DPs or screenwriters, set them up in an Italian restaurant in L.A., and they'd talk about making movies, like shop talk about making movies and telling stories and, you know, like movie nonsense. If you haven't seen it, it's an all-time great.
Yeah, that sounds incredible. I have to look that up.
Well, and it was Favreau before Jumanji and Iron Man. Okay. So it was like after Swingers and Made, the other movie he made with Vince Vaughn, but before he became like the dude who started the MCU.
Right. Disney's go-to big budget guy.
Yeah. Well, it was before he got the blank check, right? It was Jumanji opened up that door for him. Yeah. And then, anyway, highly recommend that. The gallery is interesting. They don't have a lot of technical details, but the upshot is with the screen is it's three technologies. They were like, we have these LED walls that from a camera's perspective are indistinguishable from the real world. Right. Yeah. We have motion tracking either with a traditional mocap setup or a Vive type time of flight rig that could tell us the precise position of the camera at any given instant while the frames are recording. And then we also have this video game engine that can render whatever we want at the resolution the screen has in real time, so that when they're shooting, like when they're shooting space scenes, they build a virtual cockpit, set it up in front of the thing, and they shake the cockpit on actuators. They shake the cameras with motion control rigs, and then they're projecting the starfield and the other spaceship on the background on the screen behind him, perspective warped so that it looks right. And the upshot is that, like, when he's turning and looking at one of the other characters in the spaceship, like you see the starfield moving behind it, and it feels really real in a way that green screen stuff kind of never does.
It feels real. And it has just like, I feel like the, all the in-camera benefits you get from this are just like one of the coolest things I've ever seen. Like you get like, essentially you're getting the bounce, like the light reflections, the ambiance of the background that you want to have because it's actually there, as opposed to putting it in post, right? Like it's the stuff that you would normally add later is actually present and bleeding into the scene in an optical way that you're actually capturing. It's just the coolest thing.
The stuff that you notice in bad green screening, like light mismatches where the background, where, you know, when you do a green screen, you light the characters the way you think you're going to want them lit in the background. And then if you change the way that background wants to be lit, you're stuck and you have to either like color grade or something on the, on the footage, or you have to go in and just deal with what you have and adjust. And you end up with like slight inconsistencies in how the light works on the green screen background and the foreground that's actually shot. So this, you don't have any, like I watched this and I said it on one of the still entitled when I'd watched the first episode or two, but I was like, this is the best green screen work I've ever seen.
Right.
And then somebody wrote in and was like, well, actually it's not green screen work. It's blah, blah, blah.
Right.
So it's a lovely technology. It let them shoot this much faster than they were expecting to. You know, they had a mixture. I think they had five directors who did this.
And I think they essentially conceived this for this show, right? Like, it's not like this technique was not in wide use prior to this, right?
This is the first time anybody's used it that I'm aware of. Yeah. Let's see. They talk about, they have different directors from different backgrounds. Dave Filoni directed an episode or maybe two and wrote a bunch of them. He did Clone Wars.
Right. He's mostly out of animation.
Yeah. Yeah. Clone Wars and Rebels. And he's basically like the keeper of the lore at Lucasfilm now. Right. Like he's the George Lucas now that there's no George.
Right. Instead of flannel shirts, you've got cowboy hats.
Exactly. Taika Waititi, who directed Thor Ragnarok and What We Do in the Shadows and Hunt for the Wilder People, directed an episode and is a character. Deborah Chow, who did a bunch of TV, like she's a TV background. Bryce Dallas Howard.
Yeah.
Directed what is my favorite episode. And she's like, she directs plays. Like that's what she directed up until this point. And then Rick Famuyiwa, directed another episode, the heist episode. So like this kind of felt like an anthology at first. Each director brings in a different feel and a different vibe, but the key is how they use this technology. And it was really, really fascinating, to see. So
yeah.
I would highly recommend watching it if you have Disney Plus. I enjoyed it.
The one place where this breaks down for me a little bit, I mean, I'm not saying it breaks down because obviously the technique works, but mentally there's a disconnect for me, is when you mentioned the LED walls looking indistinguishable from reality to cameras.
Yeah.
Like that's the part that's hard for me to wrap my head around. Like the tangential benefits of this are obvious. Like you get the ambient lighting on actors, you get like actors seeing what the set's going to look like while they're performing, which is helpful for just putting themselves in the right headspace or whatever. But for whatever reason, the part where you're pointing a camera at a screen and it looks real is hard for me to process, because like, maybe it's the background I come from, but typically shooting video off of screens is like the worst possible thing you can do.
Well, so if you're, but when you control, so like, it's different shooting video off a screen at a trade show where you can't control how bright the screen is and all that stuff.
I know these are super high resolution. You've got total control over what's coming out of them and what's on them. It's just something about what is at the end of the day, a 2D surface being made to depict a 3D reality is like, there's just, it's just, I mean, obviously it works, like I said.
Well, okay, there's two parts of it. One is that this isn't like an LED wall, like on a Jumbotron. These are the micro LEDs that are really, really small. And it's, we talked about it when we talked about future of display technology. Cause they're basically like, when you buy these panels, they're basically, you know, just really, really, really tightly packed RGB LEDs. The other side of it is that they are controlling the lighting, and they're controlling the lighting on the people. So they're lighting the people to match the wall, or they have some software in the pipeline somewhere that adjusts, that lets the DP and the lighting folks adjust the actual amount of lumens coming out of the wall.
Right.
So that like when they're on the desert scene, when they're on the not Tatooine, they don't blow out all the camera. You know, they're obviously not blowing out all the cameras, and they probably just light to match the scene, which
sure,
I guess.
Sure. Also, you know, honestly, at the end of the day, a matte painting is also a 2D surface that is shot as reality. So like, it's really, this is really nothing but an incredibly high tech and dynamic matte painting.
Yeah. It's the, one of the things I read, I feel like I read it in a Cinefex article or something when I was sitting at the Tested shop one day, waiting to shoot something, is like they had situations where they were shooting something and they were like, you know, I don't like where this mesa is in the background of this shot. And they were like, well, should we move Pedro, the guy who plays the Mandalorian, so he's in a different frame? And they're like, no, let's just move the mesa.
Yeah, they showed a little bit of that in one of the videos they put out.
They opened up Unreal Ed and they just grabbed the mesa and picked it up and moved it like 3 inches to the right.
Rearrange this environment.
Yeah.
They were talking about how fast they can shoot different setups in the same day. Just going from scene to scene, because at some point you're basically just having to like spread a different color of dust across the floor or whatever.
Well, and I mean, it's interesting because it does, like, it's not the same as like moving to a different soundstage with a different set of props and stuff on it, right? Like this works because for this kind of TV show, it's shot like a Western, and there's a lot of like a guy standing out in front of a scenery, in front of a backdrop, you know, looking at the scenery or like deciding where he's going to go next. And there's a lot of like quiet, introspective, thoughtful shots that are just these gorgeous, gorgeous backgrounds. So it feels a little bit less honest now that I know it's all just running in Unreal.
Yeah.
But it works. And it feels, I mean, I guess it's no less honest than the fact that they didn't fly the X-Wings and the TIE Fighters to make Star Wars, right? Those are just, you know, motion control cameras. They did present this as like a next technological, like the next leap. You know, Star Wars always presents technological leaps.
Yeah.
Then they were presenting this as this is the next big one.
Yeah, like some of that is, you know, well, all of it is very well deserved, I should say. But I did start to say some of that is a little marketing driven. I feel like it's good for the Star Wars brand for them to say every 20 years they have pushed film forward again. But like,
I think that's fair.
Like I said, it is deserved. But it did occur to me watching this. I was like, okay, this is the motion control of this era, right?
Yeah,
they developed that for the original Star Wars, and then like digital sets and digital characters was the thing for the prequels, and now there's this.
Well, and digital shooting. Like they didn't shoot. You know, they shot those movies. I don't think he shot Phantom Menace
Phantom Menace was shot on 35mm, but
yeah, it was on film. But
Attack of the Clones was shot at 1080p, if you can believe it.
I mean, that doesn't surprise me
because they were on like a prototype version of whatever Sony camera they used for that thing. Like literally, the source stock footage for that movie is 1080p.
I mean, look, it's fine. We don't ever have to see that again, so we can just move on. The sand gets everywhere, Brad.
That's true.
So the upshot on the Mandalorian is that they did manage to get a really cinematic feel on what seems like a pretty standard TV production timeline. Yeah. Like it feels, each of those episodes, they're like an hour long, and each one feels like a little movie that you're watching that just is set in like this weird offshoot corner of Star Wars that is for me, the most interesting thing I've seen in Star Wars since probably The Last Jedi. Yeah. So,
I was trying to think. I had a couple other quick questions. I don't think they've put any info out about this, but what do you think their little kind of real-time render farm looks like in that situation?
I'm sure it's a shitload of GPUs and some like 64-core workstation.
Yeah. Or even multiple workstations. I don't know if that's...
Did they say what resolution it was? I mean, no. You can figure out from fill rates, so probably.
That's the thing I would love to hear. I would love to see some stats on all that stuff.
The thing, I want to go back and rewatch it because I haven't watched it. Maybe we could do this as a patron benefit and watch, like, do a 6 months of rewatch of Mandalorian.
Sure.
Talk about each episode or something. But, yeah. It's, I want to know, like, I don't remember how much bokeh and stuff they did on those background shots. And I'm curious if they did it in Unreal or if they did it in camera.
Oh, sure. That's right. Or maybe they both could work in tandem. That's an interesting point. I didn't even think about that. It did make me wonder if, do you think there are some kind of like focus or depth of field limitations on this? Like you can't focus in too tightly on those backgrounds without them starting to show the seams. I don't know.
I mean, I hope that one of these episodes of this gallery show ends up having the DP and the lighting people talking about how the tech works and how they work with the tech. Because I feel like this is definitely a situation like with the motion control, like with the digital actors, where they had to figure out entirely new ways of doing stuff that has been like essentially unchanged since like Klieg lights went out of vogue in the 60s, right? Since we got kinos and like floods and stuff that are bright without like potentially burning down the soundstage. I'm very curious how they adapted to this new tech.
Yeah, that stuff would be fascinating to hear about. I don't know what it says about me that 90% of the time I would rather watch behind the scenes stuff like that than the actual production.
I think you like to know how stuff works.
Yes.
That's why we do this podcast. Absolutely. We like to know how stuff works.
Absolutely. Last question in that vein about this thing real quick. Do you think they are recording the lighting data, like the ambient lighting data from specific shots, like the shots that end up in the final product? So they can use that lighting data on the CG that does get produced in post-production.
Yeah, that happens in anytime that there's going to be CG in a shot, they do that.
Right. But what I mean is now they're doing it programmatically instead of, you know, with physical lights, they're telling Unreal Engine what to do.
Well, but they still have to light the characters, right?
Yeah.
So
a lot of that lighting is coming from the screens at this point, or some of it is like some of the lighting that gives a lot of character in terms of like colorization. Right.
So the backlighting is the stuff that's like coming from the scene is, but undoubtedly they have a really dynamic set of lights that they can probably control on the fly even programmatically. Cause like it's not just the scene. It's not just the scene backdrops. It's not just like the landscapes and stuff. They literally shot the space fight scenes, like with the cockpit shots in front of this thing. Right. It's, they're using it for all sorts of stuff in all kinds of times of day and night.
Yeah.
And it's really fascinating. Now, the weird thing is with this, if you're on the set and you want to change the way a building looks or something, you have to actually have the digital artists there and ready to go.
Right.
Presumably the ones who worked on it.
Yeah.
Because like, it's not like they can do it in post now, right?
Right. It's like, hey, could you break a few of these windows out for me for the next shot?
Yeah. Or hey, we wanted to have the door on the other side of this building, so it would be facing this way. Or can you rotate the building? You know, like it's easy to pick up the building and rotate it 90 degrees and put it back down. It's not easy to tear out the door and put another door in its place or something like that.
Right.
And like if there's a physical, like if it's a situation where they're building a physical building to for like the characters to walk in and then still have the scenery in the background showing through the screen in the background showing through the windows, then that's a whole other challenge as well. It's fascinating. I will watch everything that people make about this. I want to find that Cinefex article, which is almost certainly paywalled. This is magical.
Totally. A lot of interesting stuff happening in real time computer graphics these days.
Yeah.
Also, I have this hunch that if Epic ever stops having the biggest video game in the world, they're probably still going to be okay because this Unreal Engine thing seems to be going places.
It turns out I never in a million years when I played the first Unreal would have thought, oh, at some point I'm going to watch a Star Wars that they made almost like a significant portion of it in this engine.
Don't even open that can of worms, because I was extremely on the Quake side of that debate back in the day.
Me too.
When it came down to engines I preferred playing shooters in. things to have turned out this way is pretty surprising in retrospect. Yeah,
there you go. I think this is as good a place as any to wrap it up.
Yeah.
As always, we would like to thank all of our patrons who support the show every week.
Thank you so much.
I think there are more than 500 now. 567 patrons right now. So thank you all.
Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah. We really appreciate your contributions. And a special thank you to our executive producer patrons, David Allen, Andrew Cotton, and Jacob Chappell. Thank you guys so much.
Yes.
Patron Discord time.
Oh boy.
I worked on Home Assistant this week. That was my project for the week.
Okay. Yes, I saw that. You sounded like you were having a real good time with that.
So normally my approach for that kind of project, like I'm doing something that's complicated, I usually take the hard part, the hardest thing that I have to have for me to be able to use it, and start with that, and then go progressively easier. Might have been a mistake this time, but I can't get Siri to work with. I can't get it to connect to Siri at all, to the HomeKit stuff. So it won't, like, HomeKit won't work. HomeKit won't connect to Home Assistant, which means I can't use Siri to control lights. And if I can't use Siri to control lights, I'm out on Home Assistant entirely.
So what you're saying is it requires an incredible amount of manual labor in order to automate.
I think what I'm going to do is put it on a Raspberry Pi to see if it's the FreeNAS /BSD implementation.
Oh my God, don't even get me started. That is a whole episode.
Some BSD, like, it could be the way BSD is VNetting the jail that Home Assistant lives in.
Well, that could probably be worked around.
Yeah, like, but the problem is right now,
that's just a platform idiosyncrasy.
Well, but Apple doesn't give it. Apple's error messages are garbage, as well established.
Sure.
The FreeNAS, the Home Assistant error message is not, it's just failing quietly, no matter what debug setting I put it on.
That's always a good time.
Yeah. So, like, I don't know what the hell I'm going to do, but the Discord has been incredibly helpful. Yes, so thanks to everybody in the Discord that was answering questions. You guys had a fascinating question yesterday or today, a conversation
about,
you talked about the Unreal Engine stuff.
There's so many.
Yeah. I mean, your programming chat has been really, really interesting. Yeah. I think people are trying to get you to start programming.
I'm pretty close, honestly. I've been doing enough PowerShell and now getting into some bash scripting that, like, it's kind of a hop, skip, and jump away from there, right?
Do you have a GitHub account yet?
I've got like three.
Have you pushed?
No, I have not. I have not forked anything yet.
You haven't made a new branch off master?
I will say, well, I shouldn't get into this. I have an idea. Basically, I've been thinking for a while. In fact, I fed that question to Fitz through you last week about, like, hey, what about a middle-aged dude who's kind of interested in coding a little bit? I have a need.
Yeah.
I have identified a need in my daily in my daily workflow. I'm like, you know what? I wish I could do X. And I looked around and I was like, I can't find a good little thing that just does X and nothing else.
This is where it begins.
What if I just made it? So
yeah.
I'm not gonna say what it is because it's very likely beyond me, but I'm gonna look into it.
You're never gonna know it's beyond you if you don't try it though.
I'm gonna look into it.
There you go. That sounds awesome.
We'll see where that goes. And yeah, people are incredibly, not only insanely knowledgeable, like there's like just an astonishing level of expertise on there, but they're also just very gracious with their time and very helpful and friendly.
Well,
it's been a super fun time.
It's been a really, like, supportive, incredible community. Like, people are having a hard time with stuff. People come in and like, give them a light rah-rah and all that. It's been really neat. I said this every week, but I learn something almost every day in the Discord.
Yep, absolutely.
And you can get access by subscribing to the Patreon by going to patreon.com/techpod. And that'll do it, I guess. I'm glad your nose is doing better, Brad.
It's getting there.
You sound much better than you did last week when I talked to you before the Fitz show. So
yes, that was. Well, I still had gauze strapped to my face at that point, so definitely doing better than I was then.
I think Fitz is on to come back. I don't think any of us expected the source management conversation to be the thing that the Patreon went hog on.
You know what? There are a lot of Git users in software development these days. And so when there are strong opinions about Git, I'm not surprised that some people end up agreeing with them.
Yeah, we'll have to have somebody come in and talk about Emacs and VI next time.
I literally had the Emacs and VI conversation with Vinny about 3 hours before we recorded this podcast.
Look, the answer is Nano. Just load Nano. Exactly package what I told install him. Nano. Yeah.
You know what? Here's how great and how gracious that Discord is that I went on there the other day because they were also having this conversation and I expressed my insecurity about mostly using Nano. And somebody was like, you know what? Editor shaming is bullshit. Just use what you like.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, sure.
Well, and VI and Emacs are for programmers. Nano is for people who need to edit config files is the way I look at it.
Pretty much.
Yeah. See you next week, dude.
All right. Thanks for having me.
Bye, everybody. Thanks for listening.